Welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast with your host, Sean St. Hill. Sean is the CEO of Tech and Main, a technology consulting firm in Atlanta, Georgia. Listen in as thought leaders share their tips and insights about what's going on in the world of technology. And now, here's your host, Sean St. Hill.
Thank you for joining another episode of Tech and Main Presents, where we bring you the best insights from today's leaders and experts in technology. Today, we have a real treat. We will be speaking for a third time with Grant Elliott. Grant is the chairman and CEO at Astendio, a cybersecurity company based in Arlington, Virginia. Grant, welcome back to the Tech and Main Presents podcast.
Super excited to be back again. I always enjoy these conversations, Sean, so thank you for inviting me again.
Yo, you're welcome, Grant. You're welcome. It's like having your cousin back over. So this is good stuff, man. Well, Grant, so as I alluded to, you have been on a couple of different times, but for those that may not have heard those episodes, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you became the CEO of Astendio?
Sure. Yeah. So it seems forever now, but Astendio was formed back in 2013. So almost becoming a veteran in the kind of entrepreneurship space from that perspective. My background is, prior to that, I worked for a digital health company. I was both the chief information security officer and the chief operations officer. And in that role, had the opportunity to build out our information security program, our compliance program, and kind of going through the process of having to demonstrate compliance to various large healthcare entities, started to realize that it really was a difficult challenge that many organizations were facing, and kind of felt there must be a simpler or easier way. So as I kind of looked into those challenges, there were traditional GRC platforms available, there were other kind of tools available, and none of them really solved the core problem that I felt I was facing, which was not just how do we become compliant, but how do we operationalize our security program? How do we involve everyone within the organization in that process to make sure they're all doing what they need to do? And how could we build a mechanism to support that? I sort of created various different tools, bundled together different systems and processes to do something like that in my prior organization. And we were a SaaS company, really just at the point where SaaS was unfolding at that time. And it kind of struck me, why wasn't there a good platform in the marketplace that did what I was looking to do, right? There were SaaS tools for selling through Salesforce, CRM platforms like HubSpot. There were lots of evolving SaaS platforms for finance, the QuickBooks. And there really wasn't anything, for my mind, that kind of did a good enough job from a security perspective. And so that was the kind of genesis of the idea. And in 2013, I decided to leave that organization and see if we could actually build something that was better.
Oh, and Grant, here you are almost 10 years later.
Well, I don't know that I would have, but if someone had told me that back in 2013, that would have been an interesting. To be honest, those early days, I've spoken about them in the past. I mean, you just want to get something off the ground. So I don't know what I would have been like if someone had told me back then that here I would be kind of almost 10 years later still doing it. I think one side of me would be kind of thinking, oh my goodness, that means it must have been some level of success because otherwise I wouldn't be here. I'd never done anything in my life longer than 7 or 8 years. So there'd be another side of me thinking, oh my goodness, what have I done wrong, right?
Well, Grant, that's actually a nice segue, because the last time we talked, you had just raised a Series A round of funding. And before we were recording, we were kind of catching up and touched on the current VC market. But I want to get your recorded thoughts. What are you feeling? What are you thinking about the current VC market?
Yeah, look, I think that we get sucked into different trends within funding. I mean, there's no doubt that if you compare the way that funding works today versus maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago, there's definitely a very different perspective to it. There are way more firms out there, both in terms of private equity as well as kind of venture firms today than there has ever been. There's, yeah, I don't have the data in front of me, but there's way more money being invested. And from what I understand, speaking to, again, kind of some large private equity folks, there's still, even given the current economic climate, a lot of money on the side that has been built up over a period of time as well. So the opportunity for funding, and if you're building an organization, really has never been greater than it is today. But that creates a number of different scenarios, right? Not all firms that are investing are good firms, right? Like any market, you're going to have really effective ones and really less effective ones. Even venture firms that maybe 10 years ago were considered to be blue, every organization has a life cycle. And so some of them are still coasting on reputation and brands rather than positive investments. And I also think that you were continuing to see this kind of self-determining ecosystem where some of the larger entities are almost trying to create a self-perpetuating ecosystem. So it's going to look, I'm going to invest in you, and then, but I'm also going to ensure that all of my portfolio companies buy you, right, to get you a kind of traction, which is in some degrees creating this kind of almost like this kind of huge Ponzi scheme, right, where you're investing, or certain VCs are investing in companies today that, and they're trying to grow it. They call it blitz scaling. They're putting so much money into sales and marketing to try and generate a kind of momentum for that organization that goes beyond the quality of the product that's been built, with the view to eventually kind of handing it off to kind of either larger scale PE firms or institutional investors, this kind of race. And I think that's kind of creating an unhealthy element within the investment ecosystem today. But that doesn't mean to say that I think on balance, right, will you have some of those kind of bad actors, or you have some of those poor practices? I really think that on balance, that it's still a better ecosystem than maybe it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Because again, any organization today, if you have an idea, you have someone that's going to give you money. You can find money, right, if you have the right concept and the right idea.
Oh, you're exactly right. If you look at TechCrunch, for instance, or any one of the other newsletters or alerts that come across, you'll see every day companies are getting Series A, Series B, C. There's money to be had. I think the thing that you have to look at, and you can't argue with, especially in your case, is you waited a period of time to take on an investor. And I think that's something that maybe you could share and maybe encourage other founders, owners with. There's the timing of a thing. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that it really depends on the entrepreneur themselves in terms of what you're hoping to achieve, right? I mean, I don't want to say that there's one path, and it's not for me to criticize organizations that take a lot of money early and use that as an opportunity to try and grow faster versus other organizations that maybe take a more organic approach. We've clearly tried to take a more organic approach, and that's, you know, I've deliberately chosen that mainly for reasons of control than any kind of get. I mean, clearly I've not chosen this as a get rich quick scheme. The more money you take, the more dilution you obviously receive, and that puts certain decisions in the hands of other people other than yourself, and that may or may not be a good thing, right? I mean, there's lots of smart people that invest in organizations, and there's lots of boards that provide great and valuable advice to the management team of the organization. But there's also the opposite of that, right? There's also potentially lead investors that have people on your board potentially don't understand the market, or maybe basing it on spreadsheet analytics, are comparing you to other organizations that they've seen within their portfolio that might be doing things in a different industry that may or may not apply to you. It's often hard for the investors to truly understand your business. When we took our Series A last year and I got my new board together, one of the first things I did was I gave them a presentation called the Quarter Second Coach. And the Quarter Second Coach presentation that I do is based on, there's only 12 people in the history of time that have ever run within a quarter second of Usain Bolt's 100 meters world record, right? And so, I mean, that's a really, really small number of people, right? And if you were to take their coaching job, or if you were to become the coach of one of those athletes, how would you advise them, right? You're not going to go up to that person and say, hey, have you thought about improving your diet, right? Have you thought about exercising more? Have you thought about doing fartleks, right? Because they're elite athletes, right? They know what they're doing. They've got to the point, they're within a quarter second of the world record, right? And so you spend time understanding their training regime. You spend time talking to them. You spend time understanding their physiology. You spend time understanding their psychology, right? You really invest time in understanding the environment and the athlete So why is it that we have advisors that come into organizations and think that within an hour's conversation, they can give you really this kind of advice to tell you how to run a business that you've been running for 2 or 3 years? And don't get me wrong, there's certainly younger entrepreneurs who may come into an organization or set this up that don't have a lot of experience. And I'm not saying that people can't add value. And I'm also not saying that I haven't spoken to people that have given me insightful generic advice from time to time. But I think the reality is that if you're thinking about reasons for why you want to raise money, clearly funding alternatives and having more money does open more options to you. But finding the right investment partner that's going to provide advice, is going to exercise patience, is going to spend the time understanding your business and be there to be supportive, that's probably even more of a reason to raise money than the money itself.
No, I think that's a good point. Grant, let's pivot a little bit and talk about something that you've spoken on, which is called the myth of automation. What exactly do you mean by that?
So look, yeah, this is actually tied also into the kind of, I guess, the investment conversation as well. Look, we entrepreneurship is all about trying to, you know, simplify things, make things easier, create cost efficiencies. And there are some great examples of that over the history of time, right? In my space in security and compliance, the Holy Grail is it's a complicated space, right? There's a lot of work that's involved. I don't think anyone needs to be explained, anyone who's been involved in going through a security audit, just how challenging that is, how time consuming it is, how cumbersome it can be. And if you're the person who's responsible, as I was, for pulling that information together, you can understand the seduction of someone coming and telling you, hey, we have a silver bullet for that, right? We have an easy button, right? And Silicon Valley and I guess the investment community generally has been amazing in its ability to find organizations that create automation efficiencies, that take more routine, mundane tasks and find ways to automate them. The interesting thing about compliance as an industry to some degree is, when you think about the core ethos of what you're trying to do in a compliance journey, many of the tasks that you're performing are to protect against the dangers of automation, right? When you think about automating particular tasks and you look at some of the major breaches we've had over the past few years, it's not through a lack of technology that those breaches have occurred, right? Oftentimes it can be because we've implemented the technology and we've over-relied on whether that technology was rolled out properly, we've over-relied on whether that technology was monitored. Like, we have a whole industry right now of SIM tools about tracking and managing audit information. We've got a whole new emerging breed of tools about SOAR that can do security orchestration to try and, again, automatically react to events and activities within your network. There's this arms race that we've talked about all the time where the bad guys are developing more sophisticated tools. And so the good guys have to develop more sophisticated tools. And the cybersecurity industry is just growing exponentially with the amount of choice that's available. But the reality is that we've seen over the course of the last 10 or so years, and I've spoken at this a lot, is our environment has become more complex. We've long since passed the kind of the castle and moat approach to security. We can no longer just trust on where our data is and protecting it like a bank vault, right? That went years ago, right? We then started to try and protect information based on who was accessing the information, where they were accessing it from. And with the cloud, understanding that data is everywhere, it's replicated, your suppliers are in the cloud. It's harder and harder to understand, you know, where your data is, let alone who has access to that data. And then with COVID and with the pandemic, we couldn't even do it based on people being in an office or people using the equipment we give them, right? Increasingly, people are working from home on different devices. And so the whole complexity of your security environment. And don't get me wrong, there's an amazing array of great security tools that are coming out. There's device management capabilities. There's, again, you know, ability to look at data going through your networks and identify what type of data that is and alert you if there's sensitive data being parsed. But the more tools there are, the more management of those tools you require. And that's hard to automate as well. And so To me, what we've seen in our industry over the last couple of years is this kind of explosion of organizations who, again, are using this kind of Silicon Valley blitzscaling method of spending 80% of the funding they're raising on sales and marketing and only 20% on the product, where they can go out with this kind of really kind of blitzscaled approach to tell these organizations that huge problem that you have that you're really struggling to solve. We have this really, really nice, slick solution that just automates for you. And it's like telling someone who basically has health issues that you have a tablet that means that they don't have to diet and they don't have to exercise. It really is this kind of doing these people a bit of a disservice. But when boards are under pressure, organizations are under pressure, it's an incredibly seductive and compelling sales proposition. So we're seeing lots of organizations falling for that. Lots of organizations falling for terms like 2-week SOC audits or get your SOC audit done within just a few weeks, accelerate it all. And that's not to say that efficiencies can be implemented in this process. That's what we offer as well. But they've just taken that message too far, right? Automation in itself is not a bad thing, but you can't automate everything. And to give the impression that you're automating everything is kind of irresponsible from our perspective. But when you raise as much money as some of these organizations have raised, because again, you've got these investors focused on the art of the possible, not the art of the probable, then they're going to have some success. If you're spending $10 million a month to grow your business, of course you're going to grow revenue. Of course you're going to add customer base, right?
Right.
Question then becomes, can you sustain that, right? And what we're already seeing now, this life cycle is occurring, is that because we've got more responsible growth, because we've got a more responsible approach to how we manage our clients, because we make sure that we are selling to clients a service we know we can implement, we can maintain, and we can retain that client, a lot of these organizations are starting to see huge churn issues, right? They're starting to see that eventually clients, well, they'll maybe fall for that original sales proposition. When you can't implement the solution and when you can't meet the promise that you've determined in your sales pitch, they're going to get wise to that and they're going to start realizing that they've been oversold and they're going to start churning. And now what you're seeing is you're seeing some of these organizations that raised hundreds of millions of dollars now actually having to raise more just to stay viable and now going into cost reduction exercises, laying people off, which again, to me, comes to that concept of irresponsible raising.
Well, and this actually is a nice setup for this next question, because to your point, if I as a customer have been told that I can get my SOC 2 audit done in 2 weeks, well then, Grant Elliott, that's what I'm expecting, right? And so when that doesn't happen, obviously there are issues. And so this next question I have for you is, you know, what are some of the issues automation can cause for a data security program?
So it really comes down to what are your objectives as an organization? And look, the answer to that question is going to vary depending on the maturity of the organization. We, and I think this is maybe somewhat surprising to many people, we live in an environment where there's really actually not a huge amount of impetus for organizations to operate securely, to put the investment in. And again, I come back to the health analogy I use many, many times. We all know that we should live more healthily. We all know that we should exercise more. We all know we should eat and maintain a better diet. But different people to different extents will basically follow that guidance. Some people not at all, some people to an extreme, right? But we generally, for the most part, all know we should do more. So gaining a good security posture, you know, we all agree that that's important, right? We all see the news about the breaches. We see how vulnerable we are with ransomware attacks, with supply chain issues that are happening across the market. But we always think that it's never really going to happen to us. It's really easy because it's like insurance. It's really a problem we think is going to happen tomorrow, not today. So what you tend to find is a correlation. Earlier stage companies, and I understand this, right, having been at that stage, their focus is they want to sell, right? They're not fearful of the regulatory authorities for the most part. We're not in Europe, right? So there's not a huge amount of oversight when it comes to the regulatory authorities in terms of security. Your biggest fear is your supplier, so your customers. Can you persuade your customers that you're a secure organization? And for the most part, what's happened there is that because of the complexity and the heterogeneous nature of the supply chain I mentioned earlier on with kind of cloud suppliers, larger organizations don't have the resources to do the level of introspection they need to do on their suppliers. So they require their vendors to have gone through some sort of external third-party audit. The fastest growing of those frameworks is SOC 2, overseen by AICPA. And so you're seeing an absolute explosion of firms out there conducting SOC 2 engagements. And so that's why you're seeing a lot of these companies coming in saying that they can get you through a SOC 2. The challenge is that SOC as a framework, right, is pretty malleable, right? There are other frameworks out there that are very prescriptive, but you can SOC for the most part, or SOC 2 is about doing what you say you do. And step one is, what do I say I do? And so when you receive a SOC 2 report for one of your vendors, you should really read it carefully about what you can basically get a report that suggests that they've passed that SOC 2 audit. There's no exceptions noted. But when you actually look at the scope, it's pretty narrow, right, in terms of what they're saying that they actually do. And so these organizations, for the most part, are doing whatever they need to do in order to get that SOC 2 report so they can give it to their client to basically say that, hey, we're secure. The problem is that increasingly passing a SOC 2 does not necessarily mean to say that you're secure. There are so many ways for you to get a SOC 2 report today. They are through managing the scope or through going through a less scrupulous audit firm. Right. Who we're seeing some audit firms and some organizations quoting $2,000 or $3,000 to do a SOC 2. And there's just no way that you can spend the time going through the level of diligence required to review someone's controls to do it in that period of time. And so the question I ask is, are you looking to just get a SOC 2 to give to your client? Or are you actively looking to build a more secure infrastructure in the organization so that you're not going to go through some form of breach? So I think that's the challenge, that the biggest threat is people, organizations with a SOC 2 are not actually secure and they're going to experience some form of vulnerability.
Well, Grant, as I'm listening to you, the thing that pops into my mind is the difference between a vulnerability scan or a quick assessment and an actual pen test, right? And for a lot of companies, they're just looking to get that quick assessment. They want to be able to say, I'm an up and coming supplier, and Coca-Cola and Verizon are two of the companies that I'm looking to be a supplier for. And of course, Coca-Cola and Verizon say you need to be compliant. And so what I do is I think of the quickest way to get that accomplished, right? And so I would look at that $2,000 SOC 2 automated assessment in a couple of weeks, because I want to be a vendor of record for Coca-Cola and Verizon. And to be able to have those logos, right, means everything. And so I got to get it done. But not everything that glitters is gold, right? So yeah, that quick SOC 2 assessment, or that SOC 2 done in 2 weeks, there is a price to be paid for that type of thing.
Well, it completely devalues it. That's the problem, right? I think that, as I said, look, when we start looking at our suppliers, we're not going to just trust the fact that they have a SOC 2 report, right? I mean, it completely devalues it. And that creates a problem, right? Because now the question becomes, well, how do I demonstrate that my vendors are secure, right? If I can't trust their SOC 2 report, right, then what do I do? And maybe other frameworks then start coming into place. What we see is more serious security professionals, right, slightly more mature organizations, they understand the importance of building an effective security program, not just building a compliance program. One of the core, when we talk about the reason for building this Stendio platform, we see ourselves as a security company, not a compliance company, right? We built the platform to help organizations operationalize their security program. We just happen to have this incredibly valuable byproduct called compliance data, right? If you're using our platform effectively, you're operating every aspect of your security program, right? From policy control, audit management, assessments, training, all aspects of every aspect across whatever standard or regulation, right? And you use our platform to manage that in a day-to-day basis. Everyone within your organization is logging to the platform. You can make sure that everyone from the receptionist all the way through to the CEO are performing the tasks that they need to be performing in a routine basis. And you mentioned some examples of things like pen testing. The important thing to bear in mind is there are so many tasks beyond the technical controls that are important for a security audit. One of the examples I like to give, and again, this helps to differentiate the difference between some of these automation platforms that are out there just now, is you just take the simple example of background checks. And again, if you go and you talk to one of these automation providers, they're going to say, yep, we have a dashboard. You're going to be able to see users, and there's going to be a checkbox here that's going to show you absolutely that that person's had a background check done, and you're good. And they expect, in many cases, the audit firm to accept that checkbox that that employee has had a background check. But when you've done this job and you understand in a more mature environment to realize not all background checks are equal, right? Certain jobs require a background check to be done before the person is put in the position of responsibility. The background check itself might vary between international or national. It might vary between different states. You might require to have 3 employment verifications or 5 employment verifications. You might require to have education or certification verifications and validations. There's a lot that goes into it. And you have to, step one, define specifically by role what the criteria of that background check needs to be for that particular role. You have to define that point. We call that defining the what should be, right? So you have to define the what should be. And then you have to ensure that the what is actually happening matches the what should be. You can see straight away a simple checkbox is not going to meet that standard. You have to literally go in and potentially look to verify that the background check is actually meeting the criteria that's been set. And even if you provide an integration into a third-party background check services, there are so many aspects to that. Again, anyone who's gone through and performed background checks or has been through that process will realize more often than not, there's some sort of issue with a background check. It might just be a data issue. Maybe there's a matching address information for employee verification. Or again, most of these companies only call an ex-employer 3 times before they'll give up. And again, that's going to highlight a flag. There's lots of issues that typically need to be managed with a particular background that's managed by the HR organization. Again, this is just a simple example where when the automation provider promises you, we can automate things and we're going to give you that checkbox and everything's going to be okay, a serious audit firm is going to not accept that. And it's going to want to see the background checks, or at least a sample of the background checks that be conducted. And again, that's not possible to do in some of these simplistic automation. And that's definitely something that's not going to be happening in a 2-week period.
No, I think that is a great point. And so, yeah, that's the thing. You do get what you pay for. And a company that this isn't to denigrate what others are doing, or like you said, it's not to say that automation doesn't have its place or that it hasn't helped move forward some of the analog or manual processes that we're used to. But when you are talking about something as complex as security and compliance, you have to be serious and you have to be diligent.
Absolutely. And to echo your point, look, there is a place for automating activities. Our platform automates a lot of tasks, right? But again, the fundamental aspect is automation has to be a component part to the broader perspective, right? As I said earlier on, the whole process of compliance is defining what the target state should be, right? What is the optimal state? What is the state of your organization? How does it need to perform to operate in line with the security program that you're putting in place? And then the compliance aspect of that is verifying that your organization does operate in that way. Pulling in a dashboard of how your organization operates without that comparison is pointless. Pulling in an integration from an AWS environment that simply just shows your AWS dashboard in a different format. Again, I'm not saying there's not value to seeing a lot of information in one place, but how are you comparing your AWS configuration to how it should be set up? And that's the key aspect that needs to be done, and it's being missed. And a reputable audit firm, right, will come in. And the reason that you can't do this for $2,000 is because they're going to spend at least 100, 200, 300 hours, depending on the size of the organization, looking at every single control, making sure that, again, you've defined exactly what the should-be state is, and then comparing at least a sample to verify that the as-is state matches the what-should-be state.
All right. Well, Grant, let's look at this concept of partnerships. right? And bringing in partnerships for the benefit of the company and its customers. How have you developed partnerships over time? What are some examples of recent partnerships that you've entered into?
Sure. So obviously we've been doing this for a while, and so we listen a lot to our clients. And as I've said many, many times, this is not easy, right? I truly understand why people want that easy button, right? Because for many organizations, this is more complex than they think it should be. So we worked really hard with the clients we have to understand, how can we make your life better? I mean, a platform is only going to go so far, right? So we've obviously, we have a professional services organization, again, that are experienced, some of them ex-auditors, some of them security professionals who've kind of been former CISOs, et cetera. And they've been through and they've lived this. But at the end of the day, we also understand we are a platform company. So there's only, you know, a limit as to how big we can scale that kind of resources. So we've kind of gone in two different paths from a partnership perspective. One part is we've started to work with managed service providers and managed security service providers. As I said, one of my pet peeves is when people look at this in chunks. Obviously, you have to break the problem down into component pieces, but security is such a broad, over-encompassing part of your organization that even just to sort of break our part out, that can be challenging for an organization. So we work with managed service providers who go into an organization and say, hey, we'll do everything from managing your laptops, managing your Office 365 environment, manage all security, and increasingly, we will manage your security and compliance program as well. And they bundle in our platform as part of that process as a way to kind of project manage all that activity. It's a really nice synergistic approach to making sure that especially some of these kind of earlier stage, less mature organizations have a kind of one-stop shop for everything rather than having to do things in a desperate manner. And so that works really well for us because we believe that we don't have to support those clients to the same extent because we have qualified partners and doing the same thing. The other area is what I mentioned earlier about understanding and controlling the audit, right? We know that it's not easy for our organizations, especially some of the early stage organizations, to know who is a reputable audit firm, right? And that audit process is cumbersome. So from an early age of our development, we realized that whilst operationalizing the security program is a huge way we can introduce efficiency, again, trying to make the audit itself more efficient is also a huge win for both the client and audit partner. So we built a part of our platform specifically for audit firms, right? We basically are the only platform in the market that allows an organization to conduct 100% of their audit without exporting a single artifact from our platform. And the way we do this, again, is because, again, we give the organizations the ability to manage all aspects of the security program. Even the manual elements can be managed within our platform. But we also create an assessment function within our audit partners where they have a version of our platform, and these assessments can be shared with each other. So I can simply just map within my organization all the evidence I need based on every single control, and then share that with the audit partner who has their own version of the platform. And then they can, again, from logging into their version of the platform, they can actually go through and conduct 100% of the audit within their version of the platform. And we've implemented tools that make that process simple, like the ability to log questions and share information, etc. And so that's kind of really, and then what that allows us to do is because we are in control of both the preparation of the client. So we are supporting the client to build out their security program because our platform is the platform that's been used to track, monitor, measure, and manage their entire security program. And because we understand the requirements of the security auditor, we give them the ability to actually import into the platform their proprietary information request list, their proprietary audit criteria, right? We know that they're going to conduct the audit to an appropriate standard, which actually allows us, because of these partnership relationships, to actually guarantee to our clients that we actually offer an audit guarantee. We guarantee to our clients that they can pass their audit. And we don't do that because we are reducing quality. We do that because we control the input, we control the management, and then we understand the audit relationship to the point that we know that we've prepared them to the extent that they're going to pass. It's almost like, this is going to sound a little bit strange, but it's almost like we know the test criteria. So we basically are able to prepare the client to actually complete to that test, prepare everything. And we know the test criteria because through the partnership, the audit firm shares that test criteria with us at the beginning of the journey, which reduces risk of there being any kind of observations found.
So, Grant, as the husband of a third grade teacher and with a daughter in high school, you're familiar with the concept of open book, right? Mm-hmm. And I think people, when they hear open book, they think, oh, automatic A, easy A. Not necessarily. There's still work involved, right? You still have to understand the material, right? Yeah. You still have to have been in class and grasp the concepts. It's just, it makes it easier for you to complete the task now that you've been given the option of open book. And I think that's what's so cool about what you just said. You're working, helping your clients get to their end state without them having to kind of fumble through and figure out the steps that you've already taken on their behalf.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is no secret here, right? I mean, and this is the challenge, right? Going through an audit, right, is so much easier if you've done the preparation. If you already are operating an effective security program and you've already been able to map all of those activities to the specific controls, there's no gotcha here. No one's trying to come in and say, well, you didn't answer this question because you didn't know the answer, right? Look, it's a very transparent process, right? The auditor is going to share upfront in advance, right? This is what we're going to measure you on, right? And where I think a lot of organizations kind of fall down is they've just simply not done the preparation to meet that requirement. They've not spent the time trying to understand the reason for that. I speak to many CEOs or organizations who try and argue particular, that doesn't make sense, or it's not about whether it makes sense. There's a trust but verify process. You might be doing a lot of this stuff, right? And you probably are, but an auditor doesn't know that. They're not going to say, hey, Sean, you seem like a nice guy, so I'm just going to take your word for that, right? There's a trust but verify in the audit process. So if you can't provide the evidence that you're doing it, they're going to assume that you're not, and that's not going to go well for you. And so what we basically help our clients do is understand what they should be doing, build that out within the platform, make sure they're doing it, make sure we're tracking the evidence to confirm that it's being done in a simple and easy manner. So by the time they actually come to conduct the audit, that audit process, I mean, we have some audit partners that claim up to 60 to 70% efficiency in conducting the audit. And that's just because the information is organized, structured, mature, and it's there. Their traditional audit process is going to an organization and say, can you upload all this evidence in an FTP document or an FTP file, right? Or to your SharePoint environment. And they get all this uncluttered data that is decapitated files that are time bound. And they have to sort through all that information. And that's not an easy process for them to follow. So again, and making sure that this client is operationalizing all the activity is a huge part of it. And we build that into our philosophy, again, because fundamentally, and this is the part that I really try and explain to as many people as possible, compliance is not a means in its end, right? Being compliant should not be your end game. That should not be your objective. Building an effective security program should be what you're trying to do. Compliance is just evidence that you're doing that. Right. And if you try and achieve compliance, it's own right. And the challenge, again, coming back to a lot of these kind of very well funded automation players, they're not doing that. Right. They're basically almost teaching to the test. It's you do the minimum you need to do to get the checkbox and then you get to school. Right. The whole focus is on minimizing effort rather than being effective. And to me, I mean, aside from, I'm going to sound a little bit altruistic on this, that's not making our country safe. Right. We have a real issue in our country about maintaining the security of our infrastructure. Right. And these organizations are not making our country safe. They're basically dumbing this down to the lowest common denominator. And that's not a good thing for our country. And so I genuinely believe that our objective, for the most part, we want to ensure that, and we believe we make our clients more secure. They just happen to get through their audits faster as well. But more importantly, they're more secure. And that's fundamental to who we are.
I think that's a great point. All right. So, Grant, along the same lines, tell us about any exciting new developments or initiatives that Astendio is working on.
Sure. So like, there's a whole bunch that we're trying to focus on, right? We just launched a recent new module called our Compliance Manager module. And what we realized was we probably spent too much time on what I just said there about making sure that the tool was operational and that people can use it on a day-to-day basis. And we realized that there's probably a better way for if we, instead of logging in as a security manager, and as most people do, we just created a more compliance-oriented perspective. So you can literally log into the platform and you can pick whatever standard or regulation you want, and you can see real-time control for control, domain for domain, person by person, how they sit in that moment related to that particular framework as well. So it's really cool. And we've really kind of spent a lot of time focusing on the click paths in product development. I've spent a lot of years in product development. There's kind of multiple evolutions to how a product develops, right? You start off with a basic product, which is normally pretty intuitive and pretty simple because it only supports a limited number of use cases. And we see a lot of our competitors coming into the space in this stage, and they look like they're really intuitive tools because, again, they only support half a dozen or a dozen different use cases. But they're obviously limited in functionality. And once you start coming to a use case that either extends beyond the capability of the tool, or as a use case that isn't supported with the tool, then clearly that product starts to run into problems. So what do? You build more use cases. And the consequence of doing that, you get to phase two of product development, which you end up with this much more complicated product where you've added all of those different use cases into the platform. And so your platform does a lot more. It solves many, many of your cases, but maybe isn't as easy to use as a simpler product or a simpler platform. And we see this all the time with the evolution of organizations like Salesforce. Again, people would complain for the longest time that it was a really difficult platform to use. That comes you to the third stage of maturity, which is, how do I understand intuitively what the user wants to do? How do I have user-based design within the concept? If they're on this part of the platform, what should the drop-down look like? When they click on here, what do I think their next click is likely to be? And that's the kind of stage. We're into this kind of user-based design. It makes me really excited about the platform. So the idea is that it's not about adding more functionality. It's about finding the shortest path to the right functionality for that particular user at that particular time. And that's really exciting to work through those ideas, right? Again, because again, it's all about trying to reduce the amount of time that our clients have to spend on the platform, give them the fastest path to get done what they want to do, make the platform as intuitive as possible. And that's the kind of third kind of generation we're in. So I'm really excited about all the work we're doing in that area, just to try and make the platform way more intuitive to our users.
Okay. And so, Grant, beyond that, what emerging tech are you most optimistic about or least optimistic about, and why?
So I think that we're seeing a lot of a focus on integrations, right? We get asked a lot of the time about how many applications do we integrate with? And we definitely see some of our competition, they promote themselves. We have 60 integrations, we have 100 integrations, we have 150 integrations. And I think, as I mentioned before, look, the way that the supply chain has worked, right, with the fact that not only is your data in the cloud, not only are you, your organization brought in the cloud, most of your apps are in the cloud as well, from how you host your data in AWS or Azure to productivity apps you use, right? They're all cloud-based, right? Everything's across the board. So I can definitely understand the value of managing those integrations in a way that simplifies understanding how they work and interoperate with your core environment. The challenge is, and one of the advantages, one of the few advantages to being a little bit older in this space, is I've seen trends over the course of time, right? When the internet came in, I'm a former networking guy, ATT, BT, so I'm used to drawing lines between connection points to create a network. And I was always amazed that when the internet arrived and people started drawing the internet as a cloud rather than direct line points, suddenly even really, really smart people suddenly started to believe that the impossible could happen, and that underneath all of that was not just actually a series of lines and connections. And they started to think that magical things happened in a cloud. And we see to some degree some of that with the cloud generally in terms of storage, because people don't realize that, again, underneath all of that, it is just servers. It still is just physical infrastructure. Yes. that is located somewhere, right? We call it the cloud because we do some really, really smart things from a technology perspective, but it still translates down. And when we talk about things like APIs, when we talk about integrations, I think people, I ask this question, who do you integrate with? At the end of the day, you still have to have a business logic. There still has to be a purpose for that connection point. You still have to sit there and write, and what is the use case? What information are you sharing, right? It's not as straightforward as, oh, we have a magic API that just interconnects with everything, right? And I give simple, like we do some stuff on SSO and some other areas. And if you're trying to integrate two data sets, I mean, just take, for example, the concept of a name, right? Sean St. Hill, right? How is that expressed within the database? Is it expressed as first name, middle name, last name? Is it expressed as one name? How, especially people that have, is it st.hill? There's lots of different ways that a particular data table can express your name, and another platform might express it a different way. You can't just set an automatic API to just connect those two data fields. There has to be some rationality built in there to understand, okay, how am I going to manage these different exceptions, these different scenarios? And you have to do that field by field, and you have to decide what fields are basically mapping, and then you have to have a purpose, right? Are you giving them read-write? Are you giving them edit? So creating an API script, understanding and making sure that our platform is built through an API-oriented architecture. Our entire front end uses APIs to connect with the back end logic within the application. Providing APIs is a simple thing to do. But when I get asked this question, what APIs do you support, right? Is this kind of what's in the cloud, right? What business processes are you looking for us to support, right? And so I think to answer your question two ways, I'm super excited about the ability for us to interact and integrate with different applications and to create that connectivity. But my fears around that is a lack of understanding of what that actually entails and the purpose for doing it and the potential risks that creates, right? We've all seen recently about the potential security issues with the Slack integration issues, right? I mean, we even had a situation where I was integrating with our HR payroll company where I deleted a user from my payroll company and it deleted their Google account, right, because of the integration in there, right? Oh, and wow. So people have to be really, really careful that whilst there's a lot of potential utility on building API connections between systems, understand the power of that connection, understand the power you're potentially giving away. Because again, someone can basically hack into a third-party site that has an API connection. And if you haven't built that securely, right, either they can basically hit you up with a high volume of transactions that can bring your system down, or they can use it as a backdoor access into your system. So you really have to be careful with those integrations. And I think there's too many companies today that are promising integrations without really defining the business case that supports them, the reason for them, and the security that they're building in to make sure that, again, those integrations can become a backdoor access to your platform.
That's the thing. So Zoom integrates with Salesforce. Salesforce integrates with something else. And there's, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, right?
Yep.
And the thing is, who is sitting helping you put together this jigsaw puzzle? Right? Because that's the thing. It's, and we hear a lot, oh, the keys to the kingdom. And well, you really are giving someone access when that code allows them to automatically sign in or have some form of access to your environment. You have to be.
And it's controlling that access as well, right? I mean, it's not just through the API, but let's just take example, right? You want to integrate Asana into your application as a productivity tool, right? So you basically set it up, you sign it up with your SSO environment, and then you have users within your team. But do you set it up where every person in the organization has Asana? No, you have to go through a process to make it as who's authorized within your SSO to be enabled to Asana. That's a process. You have to understand that when people move departments or leave the organization, you have a way to reverse that process. And then you have to define policies for, okay, what kind of data should we be having in Asana, right? Should I be, because my project's about customer management or client management, should I be allowed to put client data into that Asana environment, right? Just for productivity reasons. And then what happens if that client data is in that environment? Does that now become regulated through privacy? Does that become regulated if I'm in healthcare, right, through HIPAA? And then how am I controlling and understanding that what data is there? So there are huge implications across any community around all of these integrations. And so you really have to go through a very structured view to decide, do we really want this integration? I understand is that we started this whole thing about this, the seductiveness of an easy button, right? It really sounds like a great idea. idea to say, hey, I can automate all this stuff for you. I can make, but there really is no such thing as a free lunch, right? Every single one of these integrations has to be thought through, has to be configured and integrated the correct way. You have to review it to make sure that you understand exactly the purpose of the integration and the impact of the integration. And again, to just go out and promote to the market, hey, we have 70, 80, 100, 300 integrations, is almost as if that somehow has value in itself. It's kind of irresponsible because, again, organizations need to think clearly about why do I want, do I really need this integration? Do I really understand the risk of this integration? Is it really going to make me forward? And many of them do, but they have to be managed and controlled. And so when employees leave or when that platform is taken away, you need to also understand the reverse aspect as well.
And that's the thing. You, as I was listening to you, you were taking me back to earlier in the conversation where there really is no shortcut to a thing, Grant. It's like, you know, and I'll just say it because it comes to mind. It's like when I first started dating my wife, we went out with another couple and the husband said, if it's worth having, it's worth fighting for. And again, that comes to mind and it ties into, there's really no shortcut to a thing, whether it's compliance or relationships, right? You have to do the work.
I couldn't agree more. And to that extent, you get what you pay for, right? Like we never tell our clients that we make it easy, right? We tell them we can make it easier, right? When clients will say to us and they'll look at our platform or look at what our platform does, they say, oh, it's complex. And again, we reiterate, it's not our platform that's complex. It's the number of use cases we're supporting. It's the environment that we're supporting that's complex. We're trying to make it easier. We're trying to make it more simple, right? But we're never going to simplify it down to an easy button, right? And we're not going to make that claim. We win clients many, many times, right? I was talking to a client just the other day. The reason they selected us as a vendor was because we told the truth. They went and they had demonstrations by multiple other organizations in the industry, all of them telling them the same story. We can make it easy. We can simplify it. We can automate it. We can do all this stuff. And we were the only one that said, yeah, it's not easy. It's hard work. We can help you do that hard work, but we're not going to tell you it's easy because it's hard work. And that's the reason that that particular client chose us, because again, we were speaking the truth. I hope that more organizations start to realize that there is no easy button. And I think we are starting to see that, right? Some of these incredibly well-funded organizations who've raised hundreds of millions of dollars are already laying people off. Right. I count some like 20 odd new competitors in our space in the last 2 or 3 years. And the sad thing for me is they're all falling into the same trap. They're all going for that easy automation angle. Right. And I understand that because, again, if you're trying to blitzscale an organization, you want to go after the susceptible. You want to go after the people that are going to sign a deal in 30 to 60 days. Exactly. Go and scoop all those people up. Right. And basically sell them on this easy because they're the ones that want the easy sell to. And I understand why that is proving to be successful, and you build momentum and you say, hey, look at us, we've kind of built all these clients, but it's not sustainable, right? And so the largest organizations in this space have had to go back and raise even more money because they're not hitting their targets, right? They're running out of market share. There's too much competition going after the same set of clients. And more importantly, and I know this from talking to some of them, they can't upgrade those clients. When those clients grow and become more complicated, these platforms don't grow with them. And then maybe that will evolve over time as they invest more money in it. And at the end of the day, you raise $200, $300 million. You buy yourself a lot of time to get things right. And so maybe they will eventually. But I think the reality is that what we are trying to do here is hard. It's complex. And we're trying to help our clients through that more complex and that more arduous journey.
So Grant, let's do this. Let's pivot into what I'll call philosophical question. What are your highest priorities in life and where does work fit in?
So I'm sure anyone who's done what I do is going to probably realize that it's not for the faint of heart, right? No organization goes in a straight line. And as I've just mentioned, right, when you've been building a company for many, many years and hopefully making reasonable success and growth within it, and then all of a sudden a whole bunch of new organizations come in that are significantly better funded and you have investors looking at them going, well, they must be doing something right. It does definitely make you question kind of your approach and what you're doing. But I think I learned early on in this journey that it has to be the journey that you enjoy, right? The philosophical component of this is not about the destination. If you focus just on the destination, then you're really kind of making it a binary component, right? Either we get there or we don't get there. And that's a lot of stress to carry. And so I try really, really hard to try and maintain a focus on enjoying the journey. And what's made that somewhat easier is each stage has been very, very different. The stage we're at as an organization now is different to even a year ago. We've more than doubled in terms of our employee base. I have a leadership team that are amazing that I didn't necessarily always have. So there's smarter people in the organization than there's ever been. And that creates a very, very different challenge. The other aspect is I now have two high schoolers. One of them is about to go to college. So with my wife and I, we've been going through that whole process. And it's really interesting to kind of, again, I'm at one end of my career, right? How much more I'll do after this particular journey, I don't know. But there's no doubt I'm closer to the end of my career than I am at the beginning. And so sitting down with my 18-year-old and thinking about what he wants to do and thinking about what schools he wants to go to and what his life looks like is, it makes you kind of really evaluate and take stock and appreciate just how much it's exciting for how much he has in front of him and how much life is. And you want to impart all this experience that for the most part is going to be okay, right? It's going to be okay, right? As much as anything else. And so that really helps kind of put things in context as well, that we have a good life. I enjoy my job. We have relative success. I have a great family. I really enjoy my family. I enjoy spending time with them and life's good.
That's awesome. Well, Grant, we have come almost to the end of our time. And like I said, this is like having your cousin come over. This is some good quality time here, man. But before we go, I want to ask you this one last thing. What's one thing we can't guess from your LinkedIn profile?
So I don't think you'd be able to see this in my LinkedIn profile, but I'll bring this up since obviously the World Cup is on at the moment. People might guess it from where I come from and my accent, but I'm a huge football fan, soccer, right? I've played since I think the moment I could walk. I still play adult league soccer. I watch soccer all the time, right? I'm loving the World Cup. It's some of the best time that I have. And so I guess, I organize my meeting calendar around World Cup games, right? When I used to work in Europe, right? I used to work in London and I used to run a European group. I used to organize my flights back from Rome or from wherever so I could be back in time for my football practice that night as well. So maybe that's one thing. I'm just a complete football junkie. I love it. I love the whole sport. I love playing it. And the nice thing is that's transcended to my kids, right? All three of my kids are huge fans. They all play to various different degrees. And I think that's almost one of the biggest gifts that I could possibly give them, right? The thing I've found in life is that I've traveled to many places. I've lived in a number of different places. And wherever I've gone, right, you just find out where the local football team is, right? Either as a professional team to go and watch or as a recreational team to go and play in. And it creates an instant community for you, which has been an amazing gift that I've had in my life. And I'm hopefully passing that on to my kids too.
Oh, that's awesome. So I do have to ask because the U.S. and Mexico will be hosting the 2026 World Cup. And there's about 11 different cities, Atlanta being one of them, which is where I'm located, that will be hosting games. So what are your thoughts that far out?
Well, Philadelphia is the closest place for us. And so I'm definitely excited to try and get my kids to some of those games. I think that's going to be a great experience. My hope amongst all hopes is that Scotland qualify. We haven't been at a World Cup since 1998. I was actually at that game. It was in St. Etienne in France against Morocco, ironically enough. We lost 4-0, but it was still an amazing experience. I used to travel to various different cities around Europe and watch Scotland play, which was, again, just an amazing experience. But yeah, we've not been to a major tournament since 1998 until the Euros 2 years ago, and that wasn't the best experience, unfortunately. And so I'm excited. I think they're extending the competition to more countries getting in, so I think there's a higher chance that Scotland will be able to qualify for that. And so, yeah, my big hope is that Scotland's there and that I get to take my kids to see the games and they get to get the same joy and thrill that I've had supporting my country.
Yeah, well, let's hope that Scotland does make the 2026 feel. Grant, again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your friendship. Just really have enjoyed connecting again. And before we go, what's the best way for people to connect with you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, again, feel free to, our contact information is on our website, astendio.com. You can contact me through Twitter, which is Astendio CEO. And again, if you want to email me, I'm always happy for email people to email personally. And it's GLAELLIOTT@astendio.com. I look forward to, if anyone's got any questions or anyone wants to share any World Cup tips, then feel free to send them out.
All right. Awesome. And so again, Grant, thank you for being with us a third time. And I know there'll be a fourth time coming up in the near future. And with that, Tech and Main Presents family, thank you as always for listening. Be sure to tune in next time when we will have another technology expert share their wisdom. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another episode of Tech and Main Presents. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Don't forget to tell your friends, and thanks for being a part of the Tech and Main Presents community.